accession number 18803, Reel 1.
Eric Simpson, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Rothwell, Yorkshire.
Which year was this?
1924.
And Rothwell is near?
Leeds.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in the Leeds area?
Yes, I did, yes.
Where did you go to school?
Well, primary school to start with, and then on to Rothwell Grammar School.
And how old were you when you finished there?
I was just past 17. I had my 17th birthday in September 1941.
So the war had already started?
Yes.
And were you living in Leeds when, in Rothwell, when the war started?
Yes, I was, yes. I'd lived there since being born.
Did you have any particular reaction to the news when Chamberlain declared war on Germany?
Well, I always remember standing at the back door of our house, and I remember it was quite a sunny day, blue sky, white fluffy clouds. And I remember saying, I don't know where I'd heard the term, but war clouds over Europe. And my father told me not to be so stupid.
Do you feel any sense of dismay about the war news?
Not really, no. No. Because at that time, I'd been planning to go in the Royal Navy anyway. So it was just, you know, something almost to look forward to.
What had put it into your mind to join the Navy?
I don't know. It's strange. I'd always had a yen to go to sea, even from quite a young age. I'd always messed about with small sailing boats and things in baths and streams and what have you. Just one of those things, I suppose.
Did the Second World War affect you at first very much?
Not really, because it was very quiet in that part of Yorkshire. Occasionally we had an air raid of small scale. I always remember cycling down into Leeds itself after the first bomb had dropped in Leeds, and it demolished a pub called the Woodpecker. And the largest block of flats in Europe at that time, Quarry Hill Flats, which have now been demolished. And that's the only reminiscence I have of Leeds having bombs dropped on it.
Do you remember which road this Woodpecker pub was in?
York Road, Leeds.
So it was the road to York?
Yes, yes, the main road out of Leeds for York.
And no other bombs that you remember in your
area?
No,
none at all, as I remember. We occasionally heard planes droning overhead, which we assumed to be German, but perhaps they were on the way somewhere else.
So, what happened next to you?
Well, I left school. I was getting a little bit tired of schooling. I wanted to get into the action, if you know what I mean. I left school in December 1941. And before that, I'd been entered for the Civil Service Commissioner's Special Entry Cadetship for Dartmouth, which I then took the examination at Ampleforth College in January 1942. Unfortunately, in those days, the Navy were very particular. I think there were 15 vacancies for the branch I was aiming for, and strangely enough, I was intending to be an engineer officer. Thank God I wasn't. But that's the examination I took. I didn't get a place. There were only 15 places available, and I think there were about 500 of us sitting for them. But after the result came through, the Admiralty sent an invitation to join what they call the Youth Entry Scheme. It's a scheme that earmarked you when you joined the Navy as a rating to be watched for selection eventually for officer status. So I signed this, and I got a friend of mine also to join. I remember we both went to the RN recruiting office in Leeds to join up. And then we were sent off to Darlington to be interviewed there by a board which consisted of a lot of gold braid. I remember a captain RN was the sort of chairman, and there were two or three three ringers there, commanders. And actually, I joined the Navy, I think it was the 18th of April, 1942. And my service certificate states that I was discharged to the unpaid reserve. My friend, David, whom I joined with, he was a little older than I was, so he was called to join permanently in June, I think it was, 1942, and my call-up came in September. In fact, I was 18 on the 25th of September, 42, and I joined HMS Ganges on the 28th of September, 1942. I did the usual 12 weeks of basic training there as an ordinary seaman.
What was that like?
Pretty arduous, I think. It gave me the incentive, actually, to volunteer for combined operations. I can't say that I was very smitten with the training at that level. A bit basic, if you know what I mean. Food was not, or it was not very good, and that sort of thing. Otherwise, I enjoyed the. I could stand the physical side of it because I was only 18 and had been kept fit playing rugby, etc., at school.
Did you not learn very much about it?
Oh yes, I learned quite a bit, but. I mean, obviously, as someone who'd been interested in the sea for a long time. In fact, I'd had a manual, the issue manual of seamanship for many years, which an old sailor had given to me. So I knew most of the stuff that we were being taught, you know, knots, splices, parts of this, that and the other.
How did the people at Ganges treat the boys?
Oh, I think all right. They were... You know, they didn't stand any nonsense, and they chased you around a bit, you know. Everything was more or less at the double sort of thing. But I didn't come across any overt bullying or anything like that. And halfway through that course, a notice suddenly appeared on the notice boards in the place that volunteers were wanted for combined operations. With the chance of commissioning. So I immediately went to see my divisional officer, and the upshot was I signed up for this. And after my 12-week course, the rest of my division went off to Chatham to join ships and other courses. I stayed at Ganges for three weeks. And then, with others who'd done the same as I had, volunteered for this combined operations course, we were shipped off to Scotland, to HMS Loch Islet, which was way up the west coast, between Fort William and Mullaig, on that wonderful West Highland Railway line. And in fact, when we got to Loch Islet, it was quite a dismal scene, because it was Nissen huts way out in the wilds, surrounded by hills and woods and rivers, which we came to know later on. And it had actually been the first combined operations training camp for the Army. They had been there before the Navy took it over. And I think it was a six-week course there, which we were really chased around from breakfast to evening. You woke up at 6 o'clock, the first thing you did was PT in the drill hall, and then it was classes all day long, navigation and all those sorts of things. The last part of the formal day was then you assembled on the parade ground in your running kit again, and off you went through the river and on whatever route they set you, up the hillside, down. In fact, one chap I came to know later, he'd split his skull open coming down the mountain at a pace. And then after that six-week course, we were all called up to the wardroom and told whether we'd passed or not. I think my course was the first one to pass 100%, actually. And we were given our appointments. I was appointed a temporary midshipman because I was only, 18 and a few months. And given my... appointment to landing barges, and I wondered what the devil landing barges were. I'd heard of LCTs and LCAs and things like that, but I'd never heard of an LBV. Anyway, after a week's leave to come home and get kitted up in my new uniform, I was then I was on my way to London to report to this Captain LCB, or whatever his name was. His name was Harrison Wallace, but his appointment was Captain LB, Landing Barges, I suppose. And went into this office in Queen Anne's Mansion somewhere in London and met him, and he was most pleased to see us. He didn't tell us very much about these landing barges. But the next step then was to go down to Portsmouth to do a newly qualified officer's course, which lasted about fortnight, something like that.
What were you expected to learn on that course?
Well, they told you how to behave like an officer. In fact, I still got some of the books they issued. OLQ, Officer-Like Qualities, you know, which told you that when you went to the toilet and washed your hands, you had to rinse the water around in the bowl, not to leave the tide mark and that sort of thing. After that, of course, we went off to the first sort of base that were operating these barges. It was HMS Manatee, which is the aquatic animal that I think they're still alive in the Florida, whatever they call them, sea cows. And it was an ex-holiday camp, I believe. I always remember the commanding officer was a lieutenant commander, very ancient gentleman. I believe he'd been an admiral at one time, but obviously he wanted to get back into the war, so they couldn't appoint him as an admiral. He must have been well over 70, with a little goatee grey beard. He used to spend all his time chopping trees down. The mainstay of the place was the first lieutenant, who was an Australian lieutenant, RMVR.
Where did you say this place was?
Yarmouth in the Isle of Wight. And they had one or two of the original dumb barges. That was barges without engines. Because the original idea had been to take these lighters off the Thames and tow them across to any beach that was being invaded by small river tugs. And then I think they got the idea that was pretty stupid. So they decided to cut the stern off and put a ramp in. And eventually engines and the steering position. But when I got to Manatee, I don't think any of those had started to filter through very much. And one of the first things I did when I went to Manatee was, after, I don't know, it's such a long time ago, I don't know how we filled our time in, but a party of us were sent from Yarmouth down to, we were intended to go to Salcombe actually, but when we got to Newton Abbott Station, the RTO, the Return Travel Officers, put an announcement over the station tannoy that this party of naval officers going to Salcombe, please get off the train. And they told us we were going to Dartmouth instead. Well, when we got to Dartmouth, there were a lot of, well, half a dozen trawlers at the buoys in the river that we could see. Each had a couple of these dumb barges alongside, and we were two were of our party were allocated to each of these trawlers, which then proceeded up channel to Tilbury, taking the barges to be converted, in other words, to have the engines installed and that sort of thing. That was my first trip to sea with the Royal Navy. I was as sick as a dog going across the bay there, having indulged in gin and lime the night before with the skipper of the trawler. I didn't touch gin and lime for years afterwards. And then when we got back to Manatee from that little trip, which took 2 or 3 days, we weren't there very long before we were sent down to Salcombe itself, where the base was just beginning to be built up under an officer called Lieutenant Commander Macmillan, who died last year, age 91. Still got his death announcement from the newspapers. We got there and things were just sort of being organised. The Navy had taken over the Salcombe Hotel, which was the premier hotel in Salcombe at that time. We actually weren't accommodated in there. We went up and were accommodated in rooms at the Marine Hotel. And we weren't there very many weeks before the Navy then took over the St. Elmo Hotel, which is out at North Sands. And that's where we were based for the rest of our stay in Salcombe.
About what dates have we reached now?
This is about late March, early April, I would think, of 1942.
43?
No, sorry. Yes, 43, sorry. Yes, 43. And from then on, we started sort of training regularly. There were one or two of these motorized barges down there, and we played around in them and practiced landings in the various coves in Salcombe Harbour. And as more and more of the revamped craft came through, we ventured further afield. I remember on one occasion, well, before that, we used to put American troops on board in Mill Bay Cove and practice dropping them off various points in Salcombe Harbour itself. I always remember one occasion we're doing that. There was an elderly American colonel on my barge, and we were putting them ashore in the harbour. It was pretty rocky, and I didn't want to get the barge stuck fast on the rocks. Everybody else had jumped off, which was part of the exercise, I think, to train them to not to be afraid to jump into the water. But this poor old colonel was rather hesitant to jump. In the end, I sort of had to shout at him rather loudly, and he jumped. But the poor devil broke his ankle in doing so. He jumped onto the rocks. On another occasion, we did an exercise with the Americans again, loaded them up, and this time put one of the tanks aboard. The barge would just about take one single tank. And we went round to Bigbury, Barra Island, Bigbury Beach. And I remember the Americans, there were quite a few of them on board, saying, "How far is France? You know, where are the jerrys?" And I know that they almost messed themselves when I said, "Well, it's about 80 miles over that way." I didn't think they thought they were so close to the enemy as they were on that occasion. And we got to Bigbury, and there's a nice flat beach there between the mainland, Bigbury, and Barra Island. And the Americans had stationed two machine guns on each side, so we did a landing under fire, so to speak, firing over our heads, obviously, which is a bit daunting to start with. And I also made several trips down to places like Foy and Falmouth, picking up these dumb lighters that had been converted. That was quite an interesting experience to make these longer sea voyage in the barge. The barges themselves, of course, if they went into a head sea, well, there was spray flying everywhere, but if they were in a beam sea, they roll like nothing on earth. They were quite dry, really. They didn't take a lot of water over the side. And then, of course, the big affair in 43 was Exercise Jansen, when a lot of the barges came down from the Solent area. And we from Salcombe joined and went round to Tenby in South Wales, which was the most interesting trip because we were calling in all the small ports and harbours on the way, places like, Falmouth is not small, obviously, but that was the first stop after leaving Salcombe, and then on to Penzance. We were holed up in Penzance for a few days because the weather deteriorated, but when it quietened down, we then went round Land's End, which I remember there's a lot of rolling going on in the seas, and we went into Hale, which is quite close to St Ives for the night, and then up the coast again to Padstow, and from Padstow to Appledore, and then Appledore straight across to Tenby, where we were going to carry out these practices with the Merchant Navy and all the other forces, RAF, etc., where they were, we were unloading these coasters and taking the stuff ashore at Saundersfoot, actually, at the beach at Saundersfoot. Well, there we used to, there were two of us actually on each barge. I was in charge of the one I was in, and I had another midshipman as my sort of number one, if you like. And we used to take it in turns to stay aboard and operate. If you weren't needed aboard, you go back into Tenby into the accommodation that was provided there. Well, after several days in Tenby, a gale blew up, and I wasn't aboard that night. My other companion, Johns, was in charge, and in trying to get off the beach into deeper water to be safer, he was struck by another barge which came flying by, and he couldn't get off the beach, so the barge itself was flooded by the seas as they came in, and in fact it didn't go back to Salcombe, it was left there to be salvaged and we had to go back by train. There was quite a few of them suffered the same way, but it was all interesting, but somehow it wasn't what I joined the Navy to do, really.
What had you hoped to do?
Well, I'd seen myself as, you know, doing some deep sea stuff, destroyers or escorts of some kind. I suppose it was my own fault, really, volunteering for combined operations, but that's life.
How did these landing barges handle?
They were pigs, really, to handle. Constantly needed adjustments, the steering wheel, and with the engines. And the means of control of the engines were very elementary, to say the least. There were two levers in the box affair that served as a steering position. And by agreeing bell sounds with the stokers who were down in the compartments where the engines were, you could pass them your instructions, you know, half ahead, full ahead, or astern. You could actually see one, the stoker on the port side, but the stoker on the starboard side was underneath you, really, so you couldn't see him at all. But it was very hit and miss, if you like.
And what kind of a crew did you have?
Well, we had a coxswain who was usually a man who'd been a London River man at some stage in his life, or from Hull, a lot from Hull. They'd originally come in, been induced to join, on a short contract, I think, something like 6 months, and they were paid some fantastic sum of money in that period of time, presumably to attract them and keep them there. Some of them, at the end of their contract period, gave it up and went back outside, but they weren't outside very long before the Navy conscripted them back in again on a normal basis, and they'd lost all their high pay and were back on the ordinary Navy rates of pay. But those who stayed on were made petty officer coxswains. Those that went out and came back again were only made leading seamen.
And could you be comfortable aboard these craft?
Well, in the forepeak, I think there were four wooden bunks, a little coal stove, and that was all. And it was very, very, what's the word I want? Stark. In fact, the anchor cable went down into the same space, so you can imagine what it was like. There was no natural light in apart from the hatch, and you had to leave the hatch cover up to get the light in, or to let all the foul air go out. As for the officers in charge of these things, for example, when we went round to Tenby on Exercise Jensen, there was no provision made. I mean, I slept under a camouflage net which was stretched across the hold of the barge in a hammock. I mean, if it rained, you got wet. Except, of course, when they got to Falmouth, there was a lot of initiative used by the ratings in borrowing, to put a too fine a point on it, tarpaulins off railway wagons in the docks, which we then stretched over the hold to keep the elements off us. Even when, and I'm going ahead of myself now, even when we went to Normandy, the accommodation provided for the officers was only a piece that they'd taken out of the hold, and they'd put a folding canvas framed bed in there, which folded up against the side of the barge, and a piece of very thin metal to sort of screen it off. And that was it. It was better, I suppose, than sleeping in a hammock in a hole that had no cover. But of course, by that time, they'd boarded over the holes themselves. I suppose they seen the difficulty of sending the barges across the channel to work for long periods of time over there with no hatch covers of any kind. So we did get the hatches covered then with timber and a tarpauling on top of it, just like proper ship's hatches. While I was at Salcombe, towards the end of 1943, there was a big sort out. A lot of the officers who had come down to join in the training schemes were shipped off up to the Solent area, Hayling Island and Isle of Wight and so on, where other bases were. And those of us who were retained at Salcombe were then formed into flotillas, because the barges were then coming through in sort of much greater numbers that had been completely mechanised, etc. And in October of 43, we were kicked out of Salcombe, because I think the Americans wanted it as a naval base. And we had to come up to Exmouth, where our base was established in the Imperial Hotel, with several terraced houses being taken over for the crews of the barges in their flotillas. I was in the 9th flotilla, for example. My flotilla officer was Lieutenant James Gardner, RMVR. The other divisional officer was a sub-lieutenant Grant. I was still a midshipman at that time. I was the other divisional officer. And all told, I think there was the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. I think there were about 5 flotillas. There was each flotilla consisting of 12 barges. And at Exmouth, we continued training on a regular basis.